Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We're going to get right into the show today. We start with Roger Isom, President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association. We wanted to talk about the upcoming annual meeting, and it's exciting for a number of reasons. First off, because we actually get to meet in person. So tell me what is in store for us in June.
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. It is the first official meeting. It literally starts the day after the state opens up. So it's. I think people are just excited to go to a meeting and be able to talk to other people in the industry. We also have the trade show that's going on with the annual meeting. So a lot of the equipment suppliers and vendors and that haven't had an opportunity to meet with people and really, you know, sell their product and just talk to the industry. And so this is going to provide that opportunity. We've got several vendors that are registering right now as we put that trade show together. And we have, in terms of the agenda, we have a great agenda set up. We've got well-known political columnist Dan Walters from Sacramento. He's going to give us his kind of thoughts on what's going on in Sacramento and his perspective. But in addition, we actually have two people from the legislature. A Democrat, Autumn Burke from Los Angeles, is going to be on a panel with Republican Heath Flora. And Heath is from the Valley, from the Modesto area, but he's going to give kind of the Republican view. And it won't be one of these ones where it's political partisan bickering, if you will. I think they're just really going to give their perspective on what's happening in Sacramento and their understanding of the ag issues and what we might be able to do better to try to push the ag agenda, at least at the state level. And, you know, one of the things that people see Autumn on there, she doesn't have any agriculture in her district, but she's actually spent quite a bit of time in the Valley. And she's actually been an advocate for agriculture on several key issues. So she's a friend, and I think she'll give us some valuable insight on what the industry and its members should be doing. Then, of course, we've got Michael Bocadoro from the Ag Energy Consumers Association. One of the biggest issues facing not just agriculture, but really anybody who lives in California is electricity rates. And one of the big factors, well, there's two really big factors, climate change and all the rules and regulations that the state has put on the utilities. And so and of course they just pass that on to us. And then the wildfires, which in some form or fashion were a cause caused by the utilities and some outdated equipment. Well, again, utilities aren't going to pay that themselves. They're passing that on to ratepayers. And so Michael's going to give his perspective and kind of overview of what's going to happen over the next few years, following on the heels of a PUC report, Public Utilities Commission report that came out last month that said the average homeowner in California will go from $378 a month to $570 a month for electricity by 2030. So that's a huge increase in just 8 years. And yes, that's, you know, homeowners, but it really gives an idea of what's going to happen to our members, whether you're a farmer with an electric irrigation pump, or you're an almond huller or a walnut processor. We've got some real challenges ahead. So we're going to be talking about that. And then the staff, we're going to give our updates on all the issues that we're tackling, from water quality to air quality to labor, all the issues related to COVID, because while we are finally starting to see light at the end of the tunnel, there are still a lot of regulations in place and people wondering what to do and that. So yeah, it's a packed agenda, but it's going to be a good meeting.
So I want to just hit on a couple of those topics that you mentioned. First off, with having the legislatures there, and I like that you mentioned we're not expecting it to be a partisan debate between the two or even between members. But I always feel that it is very good to have our legislative, you know, members of our state legislature around who don't have agriculture in their districts so that they can hear directly from the people involved in the industry. So I think that is just a great thing to have on the agenda, especially to have somebody who is interested in agriculture, but, you know, not like the rest of us, didn't necessarily grow up around it, isn't completely involved in it. So that's what are your feelings on that?
No, that you hit the nail on the head. It's absolutely important. We live in California, and, you know, more than 75% of legislators are from urban areas. So, and then if you look at the 120, right, legislators, the 40 senators and 80 assembly people, I think there is one, well, maybe two true farmers on there. The rest, if there might be somebody still connected to ag, but they're not a farmer. And then the rest have no clue. You're not going to go up there and convince people just because it's good for farming that they need to vote that way. You've got to understand their problems and try to relate what we're facing here in the Valley or other ag areas of the state to what they're facing. So we've actually, we got introduced to Autumn by actually spending time in her district. We actually participated in a back to school event and health fair that where her district is kind of Hawthorne, Inglewood area of Los Angeles. And she's right on the fringe of some pretty, pretty tough areas. And in this back to school event, we got to see some of the you know, children and families in their district. And one of the things that really captured our attention was had 500 kids go through this health fair. And one of the things they have cancer screening, they do blood pressure checks for the parents, things like that. But one of the, and they have a, they've got dental people there checking teeth and things like that, but they've got a vision van where every kid that goes through there gets their vision checked. And when we were there 2 years ago, of the 500 kids that went through, 300 needed corrected vision. And so, you know, you think about that, had that event not happened, 300 kids can't see the chalkboard, or maybe they can't read right because they need reading glasses or whatever. And the fact of the matter is that just diagnosed it for them. It didn't get glasses for them, right? But it's a challenge. And so how do we ever expect for them to be successful in life if they don't have those things? So it gives us a perspective of issues that she's facing and maybe gives us a little bit of understanding of the challenges that they face and how we can maybe relate that to things that we're facing here. We were handing out pistachios and almonds, and you would be surprised how many kids opened up the bag of pistachios and say, how do we eat this? They'd never seen it. And so, you know, you think about pistachios and that they don't have access to that. That's a luxury item to them down there. We take it for granted, right? We can go to the 7-Eleven, go, you know, pick up a bag of almonds or pistachios. You're not going to find that down there. And so they take it for granted. We did a similar thing with another assemblyman, Adrin Nazarian in Sherman Oaks. His top issues, water quality. Okay, that's a big issue for us. Air quality, believe it or not, they people in their district were having a lot of trouble with South Coast Air Quality Management District. Well, that's an issue for us here. And so immediately we were able to relate and start to make some connections there. And so we've invited Autumn up to the district, actually had her tour a farm, a huller and a processor, and actually had her talk to the employees so that they could see what was going on. And you know, is she going to vote our way 100% of the time? No, but it gave her some perspective of what the real challenges are that we're facing. And same for us. So long answer to your question, but yes, there's an incredible value there. We can't ever get them to expect to understand what we're faced if we don't understand what they're facing. Just a similar story, the Senate Pro Tem Tony Atkins is San Diego. We never think about water supply in the Delta when you think of San Diego, right? That's so far south. They don't worry about, they get 17% of their water comes from the Delta. And so when we talk about getting water through the Delta, whether it's the tunnels or, you know, the reduced pumping, San Diego's impacted just like we are. And it was something we never knew until we had actually sat down with her and talked about it. And so it was pretty amazing. We actually found another connection there. So yeah, and we hope that by bringing to the meeting, she'll get to meet a lot more of our members and talk about the issues. And she's actually going to come the day before, so she'll be there for the dinner to meet with several of our members. She's friends with Heath, so Heath has actually brought her to the farm show in Tulare. So I met her for lunch there a couple years ago. So here's somebody, you know, that really is willing to spend the time and try to understand our issues. So it's, again, I wish I could do that with all 120, but we got to start somewhere.
Once again, we're talking with Roger Isom, President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association. We're going to take a quick break for our sponsors, and when we come back, we're going to talk about those energy prices. We'll be right back.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
The My Ag Life Daily News Report is brought to you in part by the California Walnut Board.
Welcome back. Talking with Roger Isom, President and CEO of the Western Agricultural Processors Association. Let's talk a little bit about energy. You mentioned for, you know, we know what the expectations are for energy cost increases for homeowners. And, but when we look at that as a business, and especially as an ag business, there's a, I mean, that's, it's huge. It's, there's quite a bit of a difference there in your monthly bill you're going to see.
It's too much. USDA does a survey of cotton gins every 3 years. They've been doing it since the early 2000s, actually since 1996, I think. And they survey all the gins and they do a cost survey. And it's really just so a gin in California can kind of compare to another gin. Hey, am I cost effective on what I'm doing? But they look at labor, fuel, and electricity. And our electricity from California is more than twice the national average for gins. And so you can relate that same thing to our haulers and our processors. And that's not our data that we're saying, hey, we're twice. That's USDA unbiased data showing proof that we are at an unfair advantage here in California. And you add in the fact that workers' comp cost, like between California and Arizona, is twice in California what it is in Arizona. You just add all those things up, and it really is hard to do business in California from an ag perspective. Last January, right before COVID, we were at a national meeting, again on cotton, but it was in Texas. And a guy before the meeting came in and threw his binder down. And he goes, and we said, what's wrong? And he goes, oh, minimum wage went up on January 1st. I forgot to change my payroll. And somebody said, well, you know, I don't know if it's from Alabama or Mississippi. So, well, what'd it go up to? He goes, 725. And I'm looking at the guy across the table from me, like, we're at 14 going to 15 and you're crying about 725. But to put it into perspective, we actually had an almond butter manufacturer move their operation from California to Lubbock, Texas this last year. And I asked him, I just said, you know, what's the driver? And he said the same thing. He goes, Roger, minimum wage in Lubbock, Texas is $7.25. And so I'm like, I don't have a response to that. You know, it's not that he's paying minimum wage, he's paying above it, but above $7.25 is a lot different than above 14 or above 15. And so it just really gives some perspective of how do you do it, because that almond butter he's going to sell is going to be the same price, whether it's in New York or Texas or California. So he's got to have some way to control the costs. And if he can do it for half the cost in Texas, guess what? That's where it's going to be done. So yeah, the energy thing is scary. I understand, you know, the concern over the wildfires, certainly the loss of life and the amount of acres that were burned were just unreal. But the fact of the matter is the forests have been mismanaged. They haven't been thinning them out. They haven't been cleaning them out. And yeah, you know, in a couple of these cases, maybe there was old wires or old transmission poles and that the utility should have replaced. But the problem is they're not the ones going to face the burden. It's going to be us. And so how do I tell an almond hauler in Williams, California, that your electricity rates are going to go up 40% to pay for what they call hardening of the system? It makes no sense. It's just, it's outrageous. And one little known fact that most people don't understand is that on any equipment upgrades or system upgrades that the utilities do, they have a guaranteed rate of return. And what I mean by that is, so if they, let's say that they've got to replace the transmission lines from point A to point B, it's 100 miles a line, and it's going to cost them $1 million. They're guaranteed 11% rate of return. So if it costs $1 million, they're going to make 11% off of that. So it's like, hey, yeah, we'll replace whatever you want. Not only are we not paying $1 million, that's going to be our ratepayers pay that, but we're going to get, you know, 11% extra, which it makes no sense to me. I know, you know, it's an incentive for them to continue to upgrade their systems, but the fact of the matter is they haven't. They've just sitting there, been pocketing the money all along and not doing the upgrades. And again, the buck stops with agriculture. We have no one to pass it on, right? You're not going to pay $2 more a gallon for your milk, or, you know, $30 more for your cotton shirts. It's not going to happen. And so we're stuck with it. So anyway, that's the energy thing is just kind of a pet peeve of ours here, where we really fight every single thing to try to increase rates. And the legislature thinks it's the golden goose, right? Oh, we'll just put it on the utilities. They never look at how far it goes. I think now they're starting to see it. In that PUC report, they actually identified every piece of legislation and what its economic impact was to ratepayers. And by calling, you know, it's one thing if I go up to the Capitol and I'm complaining, hey, you know, my rates of my almond haulers have gone up 25% in the last 6 years. They're like, oh yeah, that's, you know, great. I'm sorry about that. We'll put more pressure on. But you start talking homeowners, all of a sudden now you got their attention. And for the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission, to put that out, the state, I think we've got some people's attention and we want to drive that point home.
Extremely important topics that will be discussed at the meeting. What are the details of the meeting and how can people get more information?
The best way to go about it is just go to, we have a separate website just for the annual meeting, and it's WAPA-events.com. So WAPA-events.com. It has all the registration information on there, the tickets for the dinner. If you're an exhibitor, it has all the form there for you to register as an exhibitor. We're also having a golf tournament with it. So if you golf, you can register there as well. It's all right there on one page.
Fun. I enjoy golfing, but I am dreadful at it. So I won't be joining the tournament, but I'm excited because I get to be at the meeting and get to see everybody in person and cover all of these fantastic topics that you've set up. So that's going to be, it's going to be a great 3 or 4 days there in Monterey.
We hope so. You know, there's still a little, what's the word I want to use? Just still a little concern hanging out there with people with COVID, but a couple of things. June 15th, the state said they're going to open it up. And so we don't know exactly what that means because they haven't put forth what the restrictions might be at that point. But Monterey is at any day now is going to be in the yellow, which is the lowest tier. And again, those all go away on June 15th. But it tells you that more than a month in advance, things are already happening. The aquarium is now open. So that's some great news. And I think people started to feel comfortable. And then yesterday, UCSF, the hospital in San Francisco, announced that they believe we'll actually be at herd immunity on June 15th, which, you know, I don't know if that's shared by everybody, but that's their belief. They actually believe that in California, 70% of the population will be vaccinated by June 15th. And so we're hopeful that's the case. Certainly, you know, we've held some COVID vaccine events at a couple of our members. We've vaccinated over 450 people at those events. Our entire staff's been vaccinated now. So, and pretty much in California anyway, if you're not vaccinated or at least had your first one, it's probably just because you haven't really tried hard enough. There's plenty of opportunities now. And so we feel confident that it's going to be a safe, more than safe event. And I think people are really looking forward to getting to the coast for the first time in over a year and a half. So it's going to be fun.
It is. And how exciting is it that your event gets to be the first event? You couldn't have timed it any better, really, Roger.
No. Well, we're trying to say that the reason they made that on the 15th is because we told the governor to do so. But I don't think anybody's buying that. But it is. Yeah, it's amazing that they picked that date. Because our date's been picked 2 years ago, so it was really out of our control. But just it's great. We noticed the difference in one and not having it last year. And really, in a, you know, our association has represents four nuts. And so there's not a lot of opportunities out there for the different segments to get together. Our annual meeting provides that opportunity and really gets people across sectors to meet and come together. And I think that's the added benefit of WAPA. And I think guys are missing that. And it'll be exciting. And for the suppliers and vendors, you know, they could go to four different meetings to get all four nuts, so they can come here and really get a chance to meet with everybody. So it's going to be informative. You know, it is definitely a business meeting, but there's some entertainment, there's some information, and really just a chance to get out there and see, you know, our colleagues in that.
Thank you once again to Roger Isom. Once again, that annual meeting and trade show is coming up June 16th through the 18th at the Monterey Marriott and Monterey Convention Center. You can find all the details online at www.wapa-events.com. Our news brief is coming up next. We'll be right back.
Agromayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, Agromayora has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, Agromayora can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Your news brief for today. The Biden administration Thursday released its much-anticipated 30 by 30 report. Michael Clements tells us how the report might affect farmers and ranchers.
The Conserving and Restoring America, the Beautiful Report, also known as 30 by 30 report, seeks to conserve 30% of U.S. land and water by 2030. American Farm Bureau Federation Vice President for Public Affairs Sam Kiefer says the report provides high-level priorities for the effort.
The goals of this report are announced in the charge the president identified in his executive order. But this report does is identify eight principles that the administration would like to follow over the course of the next 10 years to pursue those objectives.
Kiefer says the principles included in the report address the needs of farmers and ranchers.
The report goes out of its way to recognize the concerns raised by Farm Bureau and by agriculture in general. And it also recognizes the contributions that farmers and ranchers have made in conservation. This report is philosophical, broad, and high level in nature, but it identifies important principles that we can agree with, such as incentive-based and voluntary conservation, personal property rights, and continue ranching on public lands.
Kiefer says now the agencies engaged in the process will find ways to develop and implement the strategies.
Our task is to make sure that we continue to be at that table and that we have an opportunity to provide input, even though the document is complementary of agriculture. The details matter, and we look forward to being a part of putting the meat on the bones with the details and making sure that the administration is true to their promise to protect American agriculture.
Learn more at fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
Meanwhile, California Farm Bureau President Jamie Johansson said the administration's plan appropriately acknowledges the role farmers, ranchers, and foresters already play and can play in addressing climate change.
but said that acknowledgement must carry through as the plan is implemented. The state of California has already announced its own intention to protect 30% of the land and water by 2030. And Johansson said farmers and ranchers have shown willingness to adapt as needed in response to climate change. Noting the state's agricultural diversity, Johansson said California farmers and ranchers must have flexibility to manage land in ways that will succeed for their crops and employees and for the type and scale of their operations. The America the Beautiful initiative calls for an atlas to compile information on how much land and water in the country is currently being conserved. Stephanie Ho has more.
What's the vision for the American Conservation and Stewardship Atlas?
This atlas will, based on input from the public, tribes, states, and other stakeholders, bring together a baseline of information of how much land and water is currently conserved and restored in the United States, and will track this information over the next decade.
Brenda Mallory, chair of the White House's Council on Environmental Quality, says the federal government will publish annual updates on locally led conservation efforts.
So we can provide public progress reports on the work being done in response to the president's call to action.
Meanwhile,
we will be measuring progress based on real outcomes and benefits of conservation and restoration efforts in the lives of people and in the health of ecosystems, rather than solely by scale.
This is Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The growth in population of and damage from invasive feral swine has led to public outreach to help control the pest. That includes a recent video series produced by USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service using firsthand accounts of impacts to farm fields, infrastructure, and archaeological sites. Rod Bain and others cover feral swine in America in this edition of Agriculture USA.
Like to binge watch your favorite series on an available streaming platform? Well, here's a video documentary for your consideration.
Very possibly the most dangerous animal in the wild, and he knows no enemies and he knows no fear.
What is Mississippi's Hank Burdine talking about? Invasive feral swine, a pest that continues to grow significantly in population, spread throughout the nation, and cause extensive damages wherever herds roam. The YouTube series, Feral Swine in America, gives voice to farmers, natural resource managers, and others adversely impacted by this threat.
Their daily lives, their daily livelihoods are impacted by this invasive species.
I'm Rod Bain. I'm joined by Janine Neske of USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service and those with firsthand knowledge of the adverse impacts of feral swine in this edition of Agriculture USA. Why have feral swine become such an invasive pest and significant problem? Start with genetics. Texas A&M University Wildlife Extension Specialist Maureen Frank explains how the breeding of wild Eurasian boar and domestic swine produced the feral swine we know today.
The problem is we end up with an animal that is smart and adaptable and aggressive, as well as breeds at a young age and has a lot of babies and grows really big.
Feral swine grew in population in the Southeast originally. Janine Neske of USDA APHIS's National Feral Swine Damage Management Program says the expansion, though, has not just been confined to that region.
We saw those populations increase a lot, and the spread was a lot farther. They branched out from being just in the southeastern part of the country, and we saw them up in the Pacific Northwest, up in Michigan and the Great Lakes, and saw satellite populations showing up all over the place.
Which led to speculation that feral swine were being transported by people hoping to establish hunting opportunities for this species.
As much as we manage the pig, we also need to consider managing the human aspect of their spread, which is where some of the outreach and education comes in.
Including a recently produced series of videos available on YouTube under the title Feral Swine in America. The series' intent is to educate just how destructive feral swine are and why the need to control these pests. The point of view is firsthand from those directly affected by this invasive species. Ag producers face challenges, from large burrow holes in fields preventing harvest to damaged crops costing growers thousands of dollars. Oklahoma pecan grower Martin Mount offers this personal example.
The general costs for these hogs on my place are, one, loss of crops. I can't harvest it because there's big holes everywhere. The other cost that we incur is every spring I send somebody down and they spend 3 to 4 weeks down there smoothing out all the hog damage that they can find. That's a pretty big cost.
Feral swine are omnivores, as Texas livestock producer Bob Brockman can attest to.
The big boars are our main problem. They will kill the newborn lambs and kid goats because that's when they're most vulnerable, and they'll come along through there and they'll eat those kids and lambs.
And potential spread of disease from feral swine could impact cattle herds and the cattle business. This is Texas APHIS Wildlife Services Director Mike Bodenchuk.
While diseases can impact an individual ranch or rancher, the whole industry can be at risk. Trade issues are associated with disease-free status, and if we lose the disease-free status, trade can be shut down. The entire industry can be jeopardized by feral hog diseases.
The burrowing nature of this invasive pest means damage to ag infrastructure. Cattle rancher George Cook.
They tear the fences up. They just make big holes in there and just keep going. Get in a water trough, tear the floats up and everything else.
They broke that pipe here a while back. And then the pipe that goes from over there to over here, they broke it.
Potential feral swine damage goes beyond agriculture. Mississippi Levee Board Commissioner Hank Burdine talks about levee damage.
And when hogs come out of the woods and go to rooting around, they'll root up an area half as big as a football field in a couple of nights. It's decimating the integrity of that levee. We've got to go in after those hogs, damage it, and fix those areas because we cannot afford to go into a flood situation with these areas like that.
While Jessica Crawford of the Archaeology Conservancy notes feral swine disturbance of a Mississippi site that caused more than soil erosion.
Judging by the pottery that they're associated with, I would say they're about 1,000 years old. This is a lot more serious when you're talking about having human remains being exposed, but all of it is damage, archaeological damage.
The video series can be found by going to YouTube and typing in the search bar, Feral Swine in America, USDA. This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's your news for today. We'll be right back.
Having problems with nematodes? Promax is your number one solution. Promax is a powerful fungicide and nematicide that works to kill and control nematodes and soil-borne disease. Promax is a powerful and easy-to-use product in your fields. WaterRight Technologies is your source for this powerful solution. Visit WRTAG.com/Promax for more information.
For this segment, Taylor Chalstrom sits down with Carl Wyant, Vice President of Ag Science at Helier Agriculture and Vice Chair of the Western Region CCA. I'll be talking with Carl later in the week as well. That discussion is on soil health during drought. Today, Taylor and Carl discuss biological management practices to maximize soil quality.
Carl, my first question here, abundant and diverse soil microbial communities produce, quote, free services for a farm's soil. What are these services and what species of beneficial microbes produce them?
It's a great question. And I think it's worth just jumping back one layer and just describing who these microbes are. It's a catch-all term to describe bacteria in your soil. And it's also a term that can describe some of the fungal species that are in your soil. So they're all very small, they're hard to see, but we can put them in a bigger grouping called microbes. And the crazy thing about microbes is that, you know, one teaspoon of soil has billions of these microbes just in that single teaspoon of soil. So they're very abundant. You just can't see them. And so that abundance can be used in your favor to go after some of these free services they provide. And I like that services standpoint because it kind of relates it into a, you know, what are my microbes doing for me? And one thing we know about microbes in the soil, when they're abundant and they're diverse, they help free up additional nutrients in the soil because they're decomposing organic matter and helping to solubilize or make more plant available, things like phosphate and potassium and nitrogen, you know, these building blocks of your standard crop fertility program. Microbes can help release them and make them more available than they would be otherwise. You also have contributions by microbes to the soil structure itself. when you have a soil bacteria and a bacteria community that's healthy and abundant and diverse, they start to secrete these glues that help stick your soil particles together. And the fungi, they have these long threads that tie through the soil. They actually can help weave through your soil particles and tie them together physically. And your net is improvement in soil structure. So lots of small ways they help you out, but that sheer abundance of microbes in the soil, I mean, cumulatively adds up. And by putting them to work, you can see some nice changes on your farm soil.
Yeah, that soil structure is a really key part of growing in soil in general. Can you really emphasize the importance of soil structure for a grower?
Yeah, soil structure is a way of measuring, you know, how is your soil put together physically. And if you look at some of the best soils on the planet, you go take a scoop of it, and these are the soils, you know, that are great for growing crops. They have good structure, meaning their soil particles are stuck together. They're aggregated or agglomerated. And when you have that good aggregation, when you put that soil, you know, in a volume, say like just put it in a jar and you look at it, when your soil has good structure, you know, you're able to have not just the physical space and the physical support to grow a plant, but it's all everything in between. You have pore space that can store water. You have pore space between the particles that can store things like oxygen. Plants need oxygen just as much as they need carbon dioxide for photosynthesis. They also need oxygen to help run their metabolism. So that pore space can store that oxygen below ground. So good quality and good soil that starts with a good microbial community. And you put your soils back together, they'll help your farm be able to support your crop goals and productivity goals long-term.
Okay. Carl, in an article you wrote for the May-June 2021 edition of Progressive Crop Consultant, you mentioned that microbes will starve and go dormant if, quote, food isn't present in soil. What do microbes eat, and how can a grower supply it to their soil?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And a cool thing about microbes, I mentioned that abundance in a teaspoon of soil, you have a billion individual bacteria and fungi hanging out. One thing about that teaspoon of bacteria and fungi is they're all really hungry. If you look at a soil, even soils that have high organic matter ratings, like from a soil test, there might be carbon available to eat, but it's not the right carbon. Just like human beings, microbes have diets. They have the right food. Just think if you go to the restaurant and you order, you know, something like a bacon cheeseburger versus a big bowl of wood chips. Like, it's sure it's all carbon, but the chemistry of that carbon matters. And so that's why there's this emphasis and this growing emphasis to feed your microbes, and that's to provide the right carbon source. And that's a carbon source that tends to be easily eaten by microbes. So it's small in physical size, and it has the right balance of carbon to nitrogen so that those microbes can eat it. And you let that teaspoon of soil proliferate with fungi and bacteria. The second question you asked was, how do you measure that? There's a great way to do this, to measure how much microbial food is in the soil. It's called the active carbon measurement. And some of the soil labs are now offering it. If you'd like to get a better understanding of how much food is in the ground, how much microbial food, ask your lab about the active carbon tests that they have. And that'll give you a good place to start. Is my food supply low? Is it medium? Is it high? And this is a great way to complement your management program that you're putting in place to help improve that carbon score of the soil overall.
If a grower is looking to supply more food for their microbes, are there specific types of food or products out there that you'd recommend growers look at first?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of different avenues you can take from a field management perspective to accomplish the goal of providing more food. So I'll start with the food products themselves. These are things like microalgae and molasses, and there's some other products out there, some worm teas or compost teas. These are products that you can actually put out on your soil with the goal of providing that carbon source to feed your fungi and bacteria. So that's probably the most direct way you can feed your bacteria and fungi, give them the food source that they're looking for. There's some other ways you can improve your food source availability in the soil. They're a little more indirect. One is adding compost and mulch to your program. That'll act as a long-term food source for the soil as it breaks down and releases some of those carbon sources. Another popular way to provide food is use the plants. Plants will pay microbes with a food source to do work for them. They're essentially farming microbes, and that's through something called a root exudate. And a root exudate is a carbon molecule that's leaked from the root into the soil, and it's a great food source. It's got all those right properties. It's small in size. It's got a great C to N ratio, and a microbe, bacteria, or fungi can take advantage of the free resource and proliferate on you. So cover crops have been seen as a way to elevate that microbial food source through the exudates in a year-round fashion. So keeping that food source elevated, not just within the cropping year, but even in the off season.
And all of this funnels into management activities in general to boost microbial activity in the soil. And one of those management activities is what you do with tillage to your soil. Carl, why should growers be wary of tillage activities when fostering microbial populations?
Yeah, great question. Tillage is very useful, and it has a lot of benefits for a grower in terms of weed management and getting rid of compaction layers, and the list goes on. One piece that researchers have looked at is how tillage impacts microbial communities. Because if you think about what tillage is, it's a disturbance to that soil environment. If you think about a tornado going through your house, that's a good way to think about what a microbe might see tillage as, is these blades moving through or a plow moving through or a deep ripper moving through the soil, that these tillage events can be really hard on the habitat those microbes live in. So as a result, when you till excessively, you can reduce your microbial populations because really you're tearing up their house every couple of months, and it makes it hard for them to make a living. Tillage is particularly hard on the fungi that's below ground, because when those tillage implements go through, it essentially chops up, slices and dices the fungi, and you sever all those little threads that I mentioned earlier that are tying your soil particles together. So it's a cutting back on tillage where you can have an immediate impact on just keeping your microbes alive and keeping them happy, because you're not sending a tornado through their house.
And is that going to be a recommended practice for all instances of improving microbial activity, or is it going to depend?
Depends on the cropping system. So permanent crop growers are, you know, once those trees are in, on the row where the trees are at, that's essentially going to be a very limited tillage. But the rows in between the trees often get extensive tillage. So now you have a spatial component to where your disturbance to the soil is and where it's occurring. On annual crops, many growers, you know, have to use tillage to build up their beds for planting and do some other essential in-season field activities. So it's hard to say, you know, cut all tillage. And there certainly are folks that have done that. Especially on some of the specialty crops, it's difficult to cut all tillage, but growers are really starting to really pencil out every single field activity they're doing, and they're figuring out ways to combine passes on the equipment so that the net is fewer tillage events over the life of that crop.
Carl, how can growers test for microbial populations in their soils, and who can they reach out to for assistance?
Yeah, great question. So we measured the first component, that's the food source. If you want to measure how much food is in your system, to make sure that your management practices is going the right direction in increasing food availability, that's that active carbon test. And more labs, soil labs that you like to send soil samples to for phosphate and potassium analysis, more of them are offering that kind of active carbon test. So there's a good way to start on the food availability. So the second part of that test is testing, well, are my microbes responding to all this food and this management practice I'm putting together? So that's where that same lab can offer some simple tests. And there's a couple of different ways to do it. You can look at a test that looks at how much CO2 comes off the soil, and it's called a CO2 burst test. And you can use that CO2 release as a measurement of how much microbial activity is in the soil. So they'll provide you with a rating, you know, low microbial activity to high microbial activity. There's some fancier ways you can do it where you can actually extract DNA from the soil and you can plate them out and you can look at every single species in that soil and make some decisions on, am I increasing my species? Am I decreasing? It's certainly much more complicated. And I think that's where asking your lab for help with interpretation, especially on those more complicated tests, like with DNA, make sure they're helping you interpret the results so you can get some good information on your management practices.
You mentioned that decreasing species part of it. Why would a grower want to decrease a species in their microbial system?
So some species of microbes are pathogens. They're not good for your crop. And some of the work that's come out have shown, you know, certain treatments with ag products can target those pathogenic microbes. So you might be interested, is my fumigation program working? Am I decreasing the pathogenic bacteria, the fungi? Is this certain product that I've been applying decreasing the pathogenic spore counts? So that's an instance where you might want to see a decrease. But if you were looking at the bacteria and fungi that have more of a good and neutral role in the soil, you certainly wouldn't want to decrease those guys, just the bad actors.
Okay. Carl, last question here. Do you have any other tips for growers that may be looking to boost their microbial populations in their soils?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think the first place to start is to get a baseline of what the microbial activity is. And that's where those burst tests and those plate analyses and some of the direct counts that are available at a lab, they can help you really get a good quick understanding of, is my soil high or low or somewhere in between for microbial activity? And then you can look at that menu of proven strategies to support more microbes, whether it's a food source or it's cover cropping, manure and compost addition, and you can select the one that's best for your operation and that's best for your logistics. And then I think the final piece is you can use these soil samples to help look at how the quality of the soil improves over time, like that structure piece we mentioned earlier. You can actually measure the change in your soil structure by looking at how those aggregates change over time and the diameter of those aggregates, depending on the lab that you send your soil to.
This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
Thank you again to Taylor and Carl. That's our show for today. If you know of a person or a topic we should cover, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. I'm Sabrina Halverson. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. From the JCS Marketing Team, thanks for listening.